Oh, hey, I didn't see you there. I'm Nate Staley. My greatest responsibility is to serve the listeners of Off Baseline. I'm extremely proud of the quality, balanced stories that you've come to expect from Off Baseline. But I'm concerned about the troubling trend of liberal Marxist, feminist, communist, globalist, elitist, SJW news stories plaguing this podcast. The sharing of biased and false news like immigrants are people and Native Americans are people and don't be an asshole to people with mental health disorders has become all too common. More alarming. Sometimes I'll do fake news and publish a podcast without checking the exact quotes before I do a voice impression. Unfortunately, sometimes I push my own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what you think by telling you my opinion and exactly why I hold that opinion without saying that both sides are 100% neutral all the time and asserting that absolute truth doesn't exist on any issue. I'm super dangerous to our democracy. At Off Baseline, it's my responsibility to report the truth. My commitment to factual reporting is the foundation of my credibility now more than ever. I'm human, though, and sometimes my reporting might fall short. If you believe that my coverage is unfair, reach out to me by going to the iTunes page of Off Baseline and leave a review of the show and say nice things. I value your comments, all of them, and I'll respond back to the ones that I feel like responding back to. We consider it our honor, our privilege, our responsibility to deliver the news one, maybe three times a month. Thank you, and you, Sinclair Broadcasting. I'm Nate Staley. This is Off Baseline. Today on the show, perhaps many of you are reminded daily that you are super broke, particularly when you're aware of someone with money, like when you get cut off in traffic by a luxury car that you can only assume did not come with standard turning signals, and you figure, oh wow, they don't have to worry about money like I do. Or a story a few weeks back that Jeff Bezos, CEO of Amazon, is the richest person on the planet and makes $230,000 a minute or $10 billion in a month. Meanwhile, generations saddled with insurmountable debt, continue to not make that much money. We'll take a look at income inequality and social mobility. The day Trump became president again, Trump and Bolton blow some things up in Syria after reports of Assad using sarin gas against civilians, probably coincidentally, as pressure mounts from Robert Mueller in the Russia investigation, and all kinds of gross reports about Trump's sex life that we will not further discuss here. But first, thanks for listening to the show. Been on a bit of an unintended hiatus over the past few weeks. I've gone through a personal spell of crap luck when it comes to cellular devices. I keep breaking phones, my smartphones. They play an essential role, as it turns out, an ill-advised, disproportionate role in the recording and production of these podcasts. I had one phone simply die while charging it overnight. Another one had the screen destroyed from a very light drop at work. Another one was misplaced while playing with my kid in a spot that wasn't uncovered until my wife cleaned the attic and found it underneath the blanket. Yes, a bit reckless, but also I think I'm just going to get one of those phones with from the commercial with the big buttons that can just only save three contacts on it and places every call on speakerphone and has a big red button if you fall down. I am 30 after all, and that's when dementia hits, right? Anyway, I apologize for the lack of production lately. Luckily, I don't think I've missed any news, so that is good. Now on to the news I've missed. I believe last I recorded the show, I ended with fingers crossed, hoping we wouldn't be talking about involvement in a war next time. Specifically noting rumors of Trump replacing Rex Tillerson with a former guy who was too radically pro-war for the Bush administration, John Bolton. Well, I guess we don't have quite full-blown war yet. However,
video from a Reuters correspondent shows explosions lighting up the night sky in the Syrian capital of Damascus. Allied forces from the U.S., France, and Great Britain were targeting suspected chemical weapons labs and other related facilities. The blast could be seen and heard across the city. The French government posted these videos of fighter jets taking off as the secret mission began. The objective was to degrade and disable Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons arsenal. Syrian state TV claimed they were able to shoot down some of the missiles during the offensive. When the operation was finished, President Trump addressed the nation.
We are prepared to sustain this response until the Syrian regime stops its use of prohibited chemical agents.
So the Trump administration has launched over 100 missiles into the Syrian capital city of Damascus, and the Pentagon claims it has significantly crippled Syrian President Bashar Assad's chemical weapons capabilities, including a research center, a storage facility, and a bunker facility where the missiles were held. Pentagon spokeswoman Dana White says that strikes were careful to minimize collateral damage. If you'll remember, about this time 1 year ago, the administration launched missile attacks on a Syrian military base where it was said jets used in a sarin gas attack took off from. Essentially, they bombed an airstrip with the general consensus that it did very little to change anything. Well, that is other than Fareed Zakaria's standards.
This was actually a big moment because candidate Trump had said that he would never get involved in the Syrian civil war. He told President Obama, you cannot do this without the authority.
What changed last night?
I think Donald Trump became president of the United States. I think this was actually...
There we go. Yeah. Had to rewind it a little bit. But so, yeah, before I touch on my extreme skeptical impulse for ideological, strategic, and situational reasons, let me take a look at the horrific events that these strikes purported were to be in response to.
These are the frantic and horrifying scenes from a suspected sarin gas attack in northern Syria today. In a conflict that is increasingly challenging for reporters to cover, these graphic images posted online by activists and people who live in the area show victims, many of them children, struggling to breathe. Desperate first responders rush in, ripping off clothes and spraying survivors with water. As many as 58 people dead, and some claim the toll could rise above 100.
Some pretty grueling images, and if you're listening, it's just pretty horrific. Now, a more recent account of the deaths from the alleged Assad chemical attacks are over 80 at this point. It's said that there were hundreds of people with symptoms indicating a nerve agent such as sarin gas, which is a horrific chemical agent which basically can inhibit a crucial enzyme which moderates the release of a person's neurotransmitters to basically
it turns your central nervous system against itself. Kind of like a fast acting cancer kind of situation. Just a sick, terrible, just horrific stuff. Pretty frightening. There are, quote, witnesses and activists who report that jets attacked the city of Khan Shaykhun on April 4th. Reports that a yellow mushroom cloud released a fog that stung people's eyes and killed many who inhaled the gas as they attempted to help victims. And these pictures and videos of these kids getting hosed down to try to sort of, I guess, wash the gas off is horrifying on any level. If this is truly and traceably the result of the country's own government against its people, then if the international community has a way to utilize something like military precision to cripple a defiant government's ability to continue those horrible acts, then it would seem to me that possibly they should. And that's what I'll be willing to offer here. But what did the small coalition of US, UK, and France know as they launched 100 missiles at sites where these chemicals and weapons were allegedly produced and stored? That doesn't seem as clear. It's a complex and sort of drawn out Syrian civil war that now I'm just speculating here, but 99% confident in my assumption that when the president gave the thumbs up to launch the strikes, he did not have a complete grasp of the context of the geopolitical situation, which probably at best can take up to a third of his concentration split between firing Robert Mueller and suing Stormy Daniels. So just be that as it may, Assad denies the attacks and says that the videos are fabricated. Russia, a major geopolitical military force intricately involved in the region, states that the attacks launched that day were aimed at terrorist ammunition depots, claiming that the strikes may have released some of the stored gas agents. And then UK forces kind of go back and forth with them. They claim that sarin is basically destroyed when it is attacked in that manner. So most of the West is skeptical of the Russian account of those events. And as one can imagine, largely based on their public affiliation with Syria in fighting what they say is terrorism, Russia seems to be kind of committed to perhaps a side here. Some investigations do show ISIS militants have used sulfur, mustard, and chlorine gas as weapons, like in 2014 and 2015. But very little is known for sure about the recent attacks. We do know Trump's assessment, tweeting, "A perfectly executed strike last night. Thank you to France and the United Kingdom for their wisdom and the power of their fine military. Could not have been a better result. Mission accomplished." My skepticism about, so we're going to get into that part here now. I have a skepticism of any military forces or weapons used on various countries around the world, where we're simply just supposed to trust that the reason given by U.S. military intelligence or by a guy who's facing a lot of political pressure, who said things like, "I'm the most militaristic person there is." If we're to justify military attacks solely based on the reports from a system that Dwight D. Eisenhower warned us about, calling it the military-industrial complex, then we're not only just trusting a force that has killed thousands of civilians through unilateral and limited coalition campaigns over the past 40 plus years, which is an abysmal, crappy track record to say the least. But we're also trusting a system that's built to survive and sustain itself in large part through military actions, that it is also playing judge and jury on at the same time. We can point out the obvious of the disastrous Iraq war, which most are against now. But I remember even as an early teenager at the time, knowing that you were basically a social pariah if you were even skeptical of it. It was the Freedom Fries era. Then tens of thousands of lives, and over a decade later, none of the initial evidence was found. We have an environment for poverty, instability, hatred, and desperation in the region, which becomes an enormous recruiting tool for a group like ISIS. Various drone strikes, you know, even of the Obama administration, have in a smaller but still significant way added fuel to this fire. And it didn't take long for the wild card, quote unquote, the guy that I heard some lefties around election time saying, well, maybe he'll be a peace candidate or a less war candidate, which... Well, there's no doubt in my mind Hillary Clinton's ideology fits right in with this aggressive interventionism. Your wild card speculation there seems only wild in the sense that he's cranking the status quo up to 11. You know, he's doing drone strikes and he's doing a lot of them. The reports are that 2017 was the deadliest year yet in Iraq and Syria for civilians, with I guess The Intercept citing a couple of sources that report anywhere from 4,000 to 6,000 civilian casualties, which accounts for 65% of the civilian deaths since 2014. That's staggering. It's real. It's my impression is that we're stoking the flames of desperation and hatred even further without getting much of anything in return, unless of course you're one of the shareholders of these weapons manufacturers. Assad may be behind these attacks, and we have some reason to believe he might be. If that's the case, I a near 100%, but not 100% pacifist, which I view as sort of an imperfection on my following of Christ, believe that there is responsibility of those with power to help those without. And these images are devastatingly heartbreaking and disturbing. Can all of that be simultaneously be true? That these attacks are horrible, that these images are devastating, and at the same time, with the belief that launching bombs and missiles might not be the most effective or appropriate way to address the problem. I don't know, but I'm willing to consider that as a possibility. And given our track record as a unilateral superpower, I find skepticism to be, at the very least, a healthy impulse.
I got to know, have you seen Aunt Hazel? Last time I saw her, she was working tables at the corner bar, right across from the old church. She's so sweet, like lemonade on her front.
An interesting event took place a few weeks back. This inequality town hall put on by Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Michael Moore, but also Derek Hamilton, I think, had some of the more poignant and thought-provoking points made, and I'll play just a bit of that.
Everybody gets a seat at the table.
That's Michael Moore screaming.
Derek, did you want to jump in?
Well, let's even put some context on working poverty. 45% of homeless individuals work.
Say that again. I want everybody to hear that.
Actually, I'm slightly off. 44% of homeless individuals work.
Yeah.
But obviously don't earn enough to get themselves out of their situation so that they can have decent housing. 40% of workers are in contingent insecure jobs as defined by the General Accounting Office. 44% of workers earn below $15 an hour. So that's the context in which we're in. But I'm going to shift gears a little bit and say that if we really are talking about a middle class and economic security, we need to talk about wealth. And if we look at wealth, we know wealth is both the beginning and the end of economic insecurity or security. Wealth gives you, it's not just wealth as an outcome, it's what wealth can do for your life. We've talked about political power. If you got wealth, you can get political power. If you're faced with an expensive legal system, wealth will allow you to address that condition. If you have medical bills, wealth allows you to address your condition. If you want to send your child to an elite private school or university, those that have wealth can do so. We often think about wealth in terms of what the end is, but it's really the real power of wealth is what it can do for people. It gives you choice, it gives you freedom, it gives you agency. Now let's think about what wealth is in terms of numbers. Senator Sanders pointed out in the beginning of when we started that the top 10% of households, this might be slightly different than the statistic he gave for the top 1%, the top 10% of households have over 75% of the nation's wealth. The bottom 50% of households have about 1% of the nation's wealth. So however unequal we are in terms of wealth, race becomes a bigger predictor of somebody's wealth position than class itself. The typical black household has about 10 cents on the dollar as the typical white household, and that's including home equity. We talk about the middle class. There virtually has never been a substantial black middle class if we're defining it in terms of wealth. And as I pointed out to you before, wealth gives you agency. I'll give a couple more statistics and I'll sum up.
I encourage you to check that out. It's just look for Inequality in America National Town Hall. Just find it on YouTube. But now the discussion of income inequality amongst American social and political figures has had an interesting history, and it's been something that until really the Occupy Wall Street movement hadn't really been in the popular lexicon for some time outside of random C-SPAN rants where a little known Vermont senator was taking the floor. However, it's not that we haven't had major public figures in the past who have been vocal about it either.
We read one day, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty, and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
We've cleaned up some of that dirty socialist talk of MLK, so we can all pretend to safely quote him and pretend that he's kindly fixed racism for us. But it turns out he did have a lot to say about the need for things like radical redistribution of wealth from the few at the top to the majority on down. And he fused this with racial justice in some pretty eloquent ways. But we clean that talk up and let's sort of fade that. And over the past 40 plus years, with a little bipartisan help from Reagan to Clinton, Bush to Obama, we reorganized our priorities and our wealth. You know, of course, it wasn't all just the figureheads at the top, but it's becomes kind of a way to talk about it through a time period. I think there are plenty of books out there that outline specifically exactly how wealth redistribution has been created and accelerated through public policy on a micro scale to the construction of economic systems on a macro scale. So both in recent history and even further back than, you know, the past 40 plus years. So you could check out the works of anyone from Wendy Brown to David Harvey, or even Milton Friedman and Karl Marx and Adam Smith, if you want sort of a both sides back and forth perspective. But I do want to look at this from a social science perspective of social stratification and systems of mobility. And what I basically mean is the question, can people move up the economic ladder? Why or why not? There are observations on intergenerational mobility, which show us that millennials and Gen Zers have less wealth and less potential class mobility. Intergenerational mobility, meaning hard work, have a decent life, raise a family, set up your children to be in a position to ascend the economic ladder and to a high standard or a class of living under the right combination of hard work and basic good fortune, and you can just sort of move on up, have that mobility. America is technically an open system where theoretically the opportunity to move from one class to another is possible, unlike, you know, systems in the past of like a caste system where it's structured that, the you know, you're supposed to be poor and you play a role in that system by being poor. But if we're seeing a trend where millennials and Gen Z might do worse than their parents, then that intergenerational mobility isn't there and perhaps is slipping backwards, which really raises sort of a question or an observation about, you know, are we even in an open system of mobility? Now, to be fair, there is generally a basic trend where younger people traditionally are poorer based on the socially expected debts they take on early in life, such as student loans and buying a house. And over time, as wages increase, the debt is paid off. Wealth trends upward, then gradually decreases toward the end of life, which plateaus if, say, you have home equities and hold on to that. So as you die, you're still holding on to or passing on that tool of wealth to next of kin or you know, a friend or whatever you feel like, I guess. Sociologist Elwood Carlson observes in a 2015 Washington Post article titled "The Growing Wealth Gap No One's Talking About" that previous generations, like the Silent Generation and the Greatest Generation, essentially had luck on their side regarding the time they were born, since the U.S. went through a massive economic boom following the war. You know, Europe was leveled. The United States was really the only economic power that had the potential to grow and offer the sort of things that it did, had you know, people who were born that time, especially Great Depression. There were fewer people born that time. So there was kind of less sort of competition. And then compared to the population boom of later years, and then there were advances in raising the aggregate wealth floor through programs like the New Deal policies. Now, I might have a bone to pick with actually the population gap theories, but, you know, there are also other advantages worth mentioning too, like strong labor unions that negotiate higher wages. Millennials start coming onto a scene where a lot of that has been eroded. Labor unions have less influence if they exist at all. So wage growth drops below inflated costs of living. College tuition skyrockets, while the importance of having a college degree is still there and is increasing as we kind of develop this sort of meritocracy structure of, you know, having to sort of have that degree and have that education to merit the higher wages. You know, instead of just getting out of, you know, high school and getting a union factory job. Basically, with that college tuition skyrocketing and that need to have a degree increasing as well, student loans basically become that stepladder for the middle class to still be able to, the lower middle class, I should say, especially to be able to step into that and, you know, do what they're supposed to do. All of this while the floor of social programs is lowered due to, you know, cuts, a sense of in these tough times, we've got to tighten our belts and pull up our bootstraps, austerity. With this, of course, comes a bleaker outlook, a wave of increased, really, when you get down to it, depression and anxiety symptoms and diagnoses across the board. You know, that's kind of been observed in a lot of articles, too, is the impact on the economic anxiety, a literal manifestation of that anxiety. Yet as we consume the news and media, millennials and Gen Zers see clearly that there's wealth out there.
Morning. A battle between billionaires. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos versus Microsoft founder Bill Gates neck and neck for the elusive title of world's richest person.
A new world's richest person is crowned.
No one in history has become as rich as quickly as Jeff Bezos.
On Thursday, Bezos briefly eclipsed Gates for the win. When he made $1.4 billion, the instant Amazon stocks edged up almost 2%. By the end of the day, Gates reclaiming the title as Amazon's stock fell nearly 1%. Today, each of them is worth roughly $90 billion. Bezos averages about $60 million a day, according to CNBC. At $694 a second, he makes the average American salary in about an hour. The average American would have to work around 1,300 years to make a day of Bezos' pay.
I just wanted to extend with that last point there. I didn't want to cut that off. This has had effects on how electoral politics has played out. What we're seeing with the rise of populism or populist rhetoric is not only a dissatisfaction, but an outright rejection of the cultural and economic norms of the past 30 to 40 years of dogmatic folklore that basically amounts to shaming you for not being able to entrepreneur your way out of a virtual caste system. Basically, what millennials have seen offered are policies, for example, from Republicans, one side focused on tighten your belt, cut your services, let's make the business class wealthy with this false promise from what we've seen that it'll trickle down, while they pass policies that further distribute generated wealth towards upper and elite classes. Basically, when you get honest answers about how economic systems should work, when it's not dressed with the mythical folklore of terms like the American dream, you'll get an admission that, you're born into poverty, and that's sad, but that's just the way it's going to be. And with the Democrats, you don't quite get the same message, but you do get a lot of the same results, but mixed with some level of basic safety net for people in extreme poverty. But if you are offered a solution that speaks to mobility, it's usually under the premise of go get your college degree or get some level of merit. And that's how you're supposed to make basic livable wages. And also just, I find the Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, who else? Donald J. Trump. I find this billionaire cult of personality interesting on a few levels. In America, we seem to default to personality cults. It's transcended from how we spend our free time consuming Hollywood entertainment to how we interact with presidential elections. And even sometimes on local and personal levels. In a society where power is so directly proportioned to the haves rather than the have-nots, we are so acutely and increasingly aware where the true power and status comes from that we've sort of shifted, I think, from what used to be a system where the tidal wave that is American celebrity brought fortune with fame. And now we're seeing a bit more of the inverse correlation of that, where fortune is bringing the fame. And I think that I bring up this point a lot, what our value system is, and ask the question, well, what does this shift in priorities say about our values as a society? If the pursuit of happiness is arguably a chief value, which of course has long been documented as an American ideal, and if status is an indicator of manifestation of chief values or ideals, then I think it can be said that the glorification of these billionaire, superhero, super genius types like Bruce Wayne and Tony Stark tells us that a society, as a society, our happiness is tied somehow with wealth or power that we've accumulated. Yes, I hear you thinking that this is sort of a story at least as old as Western history, and I think you're right on some level, but degree matters. And perhaps as a consequence of the degree to which we deify wealth, while also dealing with increasing inequality of wealth distribution, we have to sort of come to grips with the reality that since wealth brings happiness, and since I don't have any money or a real chance of making enough money, maybe I should put my faith in a slick, super genius, superhero billionaire to fix things that I can't afford to do. Maybe he'll take me to space or give me cool 1%er electric cars, or maybe they'll get rid of all those immigrants that are taking my jobs or whatever. Or at the very least, I can absorb myself into a personality and maybe live some vicarious form of happiness. It doesn't have to be real. It just, has to be able to be someone who I can project my frustrations or insecurities or perhaps even vindications. Depending on your preferred branding, I think this applies with, you know, any of the Elon Musks, the Jeff Bezos or the Bill Gates or the Donald Trumps of the world pretty easily. Thanks a lot for listening to Off Baseline. I appreciate every single one of you, all the subscribers, and if you haven't yet done that, please check out offbaseline.com, and there's plenty of links for you to check out there. Find the show at Off Baseline or my personal handle at NateKCMO. And if you could leave a review on iTunes and just let us know how we're doing, and that's a great way to support the show, help it grow. Again, apologies for the hiatus that we've been on as a show, and hopefully the equipment is going to work for us from this point on. All right, we'll see you next time. Take care.